You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks. I'm excited to tell you about a new sponsor of the show that makes terrific coffee and also happens to do a lot of good in the world. In 2014, Evan Hafer and Army Ranger Matt Best founded Black Rifle Coffee Company to combine two passions, developing premium roast-to-order coffee and supporting the veteran and military community. With the Buy a Bag, Give a Bag campaign, BRCC donated over 30,000 pounds of coffee to troops overseas in just 2019, and they currently employ over 200 veterans. Visit blackriflecoffee.com/kick and use promo code KICK for 20% off your purchase. That's blackriflecoffee.com/kick and promo code KICK for 20% off. Like it or not, we live in a global era in which what happens thousands of miles away has the ability to affect our lives. This time, it's COVID-19, which originated in a Chinese city most of us had never even heard of, but quickly spread to the corners of the earth. Next time, it could well be another infectious disease from somewhere else. 20 years ago, it was a group of terrorists trained in Afghanistan and armed with box cutters who commandeered 4 planes and flew them into buildings, claiming nearly 3,000 lives. In 2016, hackers in a nondescript office building in Russia traveled virtually in cyberspace to manipulate America's elections. In 2008, it was a global financial crisis caused by mortgage-backed securities in America. But one day, it could well be a financial contagion originating in Europe, Asia, or Africa. This is the new normal of the 21st century. And globalism is not a choice, but a fact. Now, Dr. Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and a seasoned diplomat who served under 4 presidents, is helping make sense of this complicated and interconnected world with a new book called The World, A Brief Introduction. And today, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Haass back to the show to discuss the foreign relations aspect of the current pandemic, his concerns that the crisis may lead to more isolationism and nationalism instead of greater cooperation, and what the pandemic might mean for U.S.-China relations. He addresses why terms like globalism and world order are such hot buttons for many Americans, and why the negatives of globalism and trade often overshadow the many benefits. Dr. Haass talks about the current post-Cold War period and why we still struggle to define it 30 years in. And he proposes that the world may have to rethink its ideas about national sovereignty to address problems that know no borders, like COVID-19 and climate change. Plus, he outlines the most urgent global problems that the world faces in the 21st century, the regions of the world that worry him most, and why he believes the U.S. shouldn't get out of the nation-building business just yet. Coming up with Dr. Richard Haass in just a moment. Dr. Richard Haass is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. An experienced diplomat and policymaker who served under 4 presidents, he was the senior Middle East advisor to President George H.W. Bush, Director of the Policy Planning Staff under Secretary of State Colin Powell, and the U.S. envoy to both the Cyprus and Northern Ireland peace talks. A recipient of the Presidential Citizens Medal, the State Department's Distinguished Honor Award, and the Tipperary International Peace Award, he's also the author or editor of 14 books, including the best-selling A World in Disarray. And now he's out with a new book, The World, A Brief Introduction. Dr. Richard Haass, welcome back to the show.
Call me Richard, and thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, Richard, I want to begin first by discussing the pandemic from a foreign policy standpoint, and certainly some of this will inevitably go into the issues that you discuss in your book. Do you think that this pandemic was a predictable outcome?
Well, the pandemic was both predictable and predicted. All sorts of people for years in the public health field had said it's a question of when and not if. Mm-hmm. We are going to face either a virus that was extraordinarily virulent, or we would face some type of bacteria that was resistant to antibiotics. And over the years, we did have things like SARS and Ebola. So the idea of global pandemics is part and parcel of globalization. What was different here was, one, the Chinese mishandling of the outbreak of the disease. Two, the nature of the disease itself, how contagious it is and how strong it is. And then thirdly, the inept American reaction to it. So nothing was inevitable in the specific sense. Had the Chinese, for example, not had certain markets open, this may never have happened, mm-hmm. if in fact it did begin in a market. But I think in general, this is one of the examples of contemporary globalization. So if it didn't happen this time, it was going to happen in another place at another time.
How should the U.S. address the fact that COVID-19 originated in China and allowed it to escape its borders and wasn't transparent with its own people or the world about it? Should there be an investigation or even consequences to China's role in all this?
Well, I would think there should be an investigation, not simply to pin responsibility where it belongs, but there might be some lessons here. For example, the fact that these markets in China have once again opened in certain places seems to me crazy, mm-hmm. given what has happened. If there was any connection between the laboratory and Wuhan, again, we ought to know that because it might mean that either protocols in place are inadequate or obviously they were not observed. The question of Chinese responsibility is a big one. And the question is, yes, they bear some responsibility clearly for the fact that this came out of China and spread. The question is how that ought to be manifested or dealt with is a big question. And I would say one has to look at it not in the narrow context, but against the context of everything that China is doing or could do. So simply because they behave badly doesn't mean that we can, for example, force them to pay certain types of quote unquote reparations for this. One, they might resist. Two, they've got economic tools they can use to push back. And one of the important ideas in the world is a degree of sovereign immunity that we ought not to be essentially treating one another as and the world as a court of law, lest we find ourselves in the dock because of something we are doing in terms of how we conduct a war or what we're not doing against climate change. So by and large, I don't think these things ought to be dealt with legally, but I do think China ought to be held accountable and its reputation ought to take a major hit as a result.
And of course, in a lot of ways, it seems that the beneficiary of this pandemic that started within its borders has been China. Much of the necessary medical equipment being used is coming from China. China is taking advantage of the chaos to make moves in the South China Sea and crack down in Hong Kong. It almost makes me wonder if they might even be contemplating a more aggressive stance toward Taiwan right now. You know, never let a good crisis go to waste. Do you think this might be the opportunity that China has been waiting for?
Look, I can't sit here and rule that out, but if they were to do something against Taiwan, not only would it risk or bring about a military conflict, but it would fundamentally change China's relationship with every country in the Asia-Pacific region. At the end of the day, whatever China might accomplish vis-a-vis Taiwan, it would so poison its relationship with the United States, with Japan, with South Korea and others that I think on balance, China would be a net loser. Let me also just take slight issue with what you said. I'm not sure China will be a net gainer. It's possible that, yes, we could be distracted and take our eye off the ball with Taiwan or something else. But let's see how this plays out internally in China. If there are now new outbreaks someone like Xi Jinping, who has so consolidated power in China, it's very hard for him to blame this on anybody else. Let's see how China's economy recovers. It's easy to send people back into the office. It's hard to keep them there if there's new disease outbreaks. China's reputation in Europe and parts of Europe may have taken a real hit. I think it's too soon to do a balance sheet on what the impact will be of COVID-19 on China's standing in the world.
What's your best guess on what this might mean for Sino-American relations? Is there any scenario in which this ends with greater cooperation between the U.S. and China on COVID-19 and other critical issues? Or is it more likely to be more finger-pointing and to make an already frayed relationship even worse?
I think the way you ended your question is by far the more likely path, that it takes a relationship that was deteriorating and it adds to it. But could it change? Yeah, I could imagine a scenario where the Chinese leadership would internalize the idea that this was really hurting them with the United States and with others. And they might look for ways to improve their standing. They did try this to some extent by trying to make available various types of PPE, medical gear. Mm-hmm. If they were to be one of the early ones to develop a vaccine, they might decide to make that available to others. I could also see them suggesting some joint projects around the world with the United States, either on the medical side or the economic side of this crisis. They might agree to some change in the World Health Organization. But all things being equal, you'd have to be a real optimist to think that this is a cloud with a serious silver lining.
In terms of a global body addressing COVID-19, we, of course, have the World Health Organization, but even you admit in your book that WHO doesn't really live up to its lofty title. And I'm seeing very little in terms of a globally coordinated effort to combat this virus. It's every nation for itself, including the U.S. It seems to me that a crisis that should bring the world together is only hardening isolationism and nationalism.
You may well be right. It'd be one of the ironies of this, that a quintessential global problem, a pandemic, which knows no respect for borders, has the effect of strengthening borders and weakening global cooperation. That could well happen. Even if a vaccine were to emerge, there may be quite a lot of competition for who has access to it. There's already competition for who in the queue of countries lining up for support from the IMF or other sources of funds to help bail out their economies. So, it's quite possible that, the Middle East is proof that bad situations can always get worse. And we may see that writ large on a global scene here.
You say in your book that globalization is not a policy preference. Globalization is a reality. In that sense, is the pandemic perhaps the wake-up call that we needed?
Well, from your mouth to God's ear. on the other hand, we've had other wake-up calls. 9/11 was a wake-up call.
Right.
Not just about terrorism, but something that began in remote parts of a remote country called Afghanistan could end up killing 3,000 people in a day. We've had several financial crises that ought to have been wake-up calls. Climate change, the kind of fires and storms that we've seen in recent years, that ought to have been a wake-up call. So far, at least, the world seems to be a sound sleeper. And the question is, will this be a wake-up call either in the realm of global health or more broadly? I don't know. I worry, for example, in this country, the pushback against expertise, the pushback against science. So it's not obvious to me that this will galvanize the sort of response someone like me would want to see. But that ought to be the reaction, that even if we were caught unprepared, I would hope that this would galvanize greater effort in the realm of global health. And people would say, where else can globalization really hurt us? The list would obviously begin but not end with climate change. And I would want to see various types of efforts taken both to deal with the source of the problem, but also to make us more resilient.
And that seems to be part of your goal with The World, A Brief Introduction. You say that you want to increase global literacy, but you're not talking about reading when you say that. What do you mean by global literacy?
Right. Yeah, it's a phrase I used with some trepidation. As much as it turns out, probably 750 million people in the world cannot read. But when I use the phrase global literacy, I mean awareness and understanding of the world, how it works, its importance. And what I would like to see is people everywhere, but let me focus for a minute on the United States. I'd like to see people with a greater understanding. I think that way they would become or could become better informed citizens. They could then ask questions. They could make better judgments in the voting booth. They could hold elected representatives and officials more to account. And then personally, they could make better business decisions, better career decisions, better investment decisions. So I would like to see Americans become more comfortable with and more knowledgeable about this world, which is, as we're seeing now, hour to hour, is so affecting their lives.
Many Americans just don't understand why the world should matter to them. But the fact that we haven't had a world war over the past 75 years is no accident. And perhaps it's difficult for the average American to quantify the financial impact of cheaper cars, cheaper smartphones, cheaper produce thanks to trade. Is that part of the problem, that the benefits of diplomacy and globalism aren't felt as acutely as the negative impacts?
Absolutely. 100%. It's frustrating for me. People tend to see the costs, and there are real costs at times to globalization or foreign policy. There's the budgetary costs. Sometimes you go to war, wisely or unwisely, and obviously it's expensive in terms of human life or in terms of dollars. So I understand that foreign policy is, in that sense, controversial. It doesn't have a natural constituency. But as you say, over the last 70 years, we avoided anything like the sorts of global conflicts that so plagued the world in the first half of the 20th century. It was also a time when global lifespans improved significantly. Standards of living rose dramatically. The number of people enjoying relatively free lives also went up. It was really quite an extraordinary era. And I think people tend to take it for granted. And then when you have bad experiences, say like the Iraq War or Afghanistan, it reinforces the sense that foreign policy is all about costs and not benefits. And to be honest, and I know this from personal experience in my own conversations with him, Donald Trump believes that he came into office as a businessman who basically saw foreign policy only as adding to costs, not to revenues. And he thought that trade and allies were essentially, again, taking advantage of the United States, that we were in the net losers. So his approach to foreign policy is very much to limit it and is to try to disrupt economic relationships and other relationships that he thinks have not been to our advantage. And in the absence of a president who's going to do the 21st century version of a fireside chat to explain some of the realities of America's influence on the world for the good and some of the realities of the world's ability to affect us, then I think it's going to be very hard to change the debate in the United States, which again is why it's why I wrote this book. It was my attempt to throw a pebble into this pond.
Right. And that zero-sum game just doesn't hold up in a situation like this pandemic. There are no winners. There are only losers, although perhaps to varying degrees. Now, in the world, a brief introduction. Our old friend, the Peace of Westphalia, comes back again. As you discussed in your previous book, The World in Disarray, Westphalia really codified this idea of national sovereignty to the extent that live and let live has gradually become the dominant foreign policy over the past couple of centuries. Is sovereignty still sacrosanct, or do we need to rethink sovereignty in a time when problems like climate change, pandemics, terrorism respect no borders?
It's a great question. On one hand, you want to still embrace sovereignty. We don't want to go back to a world where everybody was intervening and invading everybody else. And in the last couple of decades, we've seen Saddam Hussein's Iraq invade Kuwait. We've seen Vladimir Putin's Russia invade Ukraine. So we still have to worry about a world in which sovereignty is not embraced. But I think one of the most interesting innovations in thinking in the field over the last couple of decades has been the idea that there's also such a thing as too much sovereignty. We saw it originally in the case of genocides. We didn't want governments to feel that they could commit genocides or allow them to take place on their own territory. So that was one area that led to this idea of the responsibility to protect, the idea that if governments don't act responsibly, don't behave correctly, that they forfeit some of the normal rights of sovereignty. I think that was a big idea. There's a growing debate about a country like Brazil. Brazil is home to most of the Amazon rainforest. That's a rainforest that affects the climate of the world, not just Brazil. And this government is not acting as a responsible custodian. So what should the world do? And I've suggested the correctness of sanctioning the government of Brazil, because what it's doing is not bad just for itself. That'd be one thing, but it's bad for the rest of us. Or the question you began with about China. If a country won't meet its obligations to act as a responsible citizen in terms of dealing with public health, and disease is allowed to not just break out, but spread, and the rest of us pay a price for it, what is the world to do about it? 9/11. The United States removed the Taliban government from power in Afghanistan, not because the Taliban government directly attacked the United States, but because it had allowed its territory to be used by terrorists who trained there and then go on to attack us. So in all these cases, what we're doing now is rethinking this idea of sovereignty and basically saying, okay, in principle, in general, it's a good thing. But in certain specific areas, when things are allowed to happen within the territories of a country that can, in particular, affect our own well-being, our own interests, they can no longer be allowed to have a free hand. Mm-hmm. But how we structure that, how we make that work, that's a big, big question right now.
Still, do you think that the U.S. has been a little too quick to use military systems to solve matters that are perhaps better suited to a diplomatic approach?
I do. And what's interesting is virtually every former Secretary of Defense would agree with me. Several of them, Bob Gates, Ash Carter, and the rest, have made comments that they would have gladly given up a few dollars in their own budget and put it in the State Department's budget, either for foreign aid or for diplomacy. Ash Carter, I remember at one point, who was, the last Secretary of Defense under the previous president, basically said if the United States had entered the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the regional economic and political grouping in Asia, it would have been worth more than a carrier task force in terms of pushing back against Chinese influence. So, yeah, I think there is a tendency to overuse the military tool sometimes and to underuse or even ignore some of the other tools.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. The first section of the book deals with history. First, the post-Westphalian era, then you have World War I, World War II, the Cold War, and finally, the post-Cold War era that we now find ourselves in. Goes from 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, to the present and foreseeable future. That's as long or longer than the period that included both world wars. And yet, here we are, we still struggle to define this moment in any other way than in terms of the past, the post-Cold War era. Why do you think the past three decades continue to lack a coherent identity of their own?
That's a really good question. I think the main reason is the era began with the United States enjoying a degree of power, what's called in our business primacy advantage, but we didn't really do much with it. We squandered it, I think historians will judge. So we didn't build institutions or arrangements that will endure. So what's happened is our degree of primacy, our relative position in the world, has deteriorated, in part because others have gotten stronger, in part because we've lost some of our will to act, in part because this new generation of global issues has arrived on the scene. And so things have deteriorated, but things haven't settled down or sorted out. Usually eras gain their name, they gain their definition and character when something big and lasting happens, for better and for worse. The period after World War I, for example, didn't have a name until World War II came around, and it was known as the interwar period. We then had the Cold War. Now, it's quite possible if at the end of this period we have a U.S.-Chinese Cold War, if that were to come to pass, this may be known as the inter-Cold War period, from a U.S.-Soviet to a U.S.-Chinese Cold War. That could still happen. It could still end up being a period of creativity and global institution building, or it could be just the opposite. It could be a period, as this pandemic suggests, where pandemic challenges overwhelm us. I think it's still it's a little bit like a baseball game in the, I don't know if it's the second inning, the fourth inning, the eighth inning, to be determined. The good news in that, by the way, is despite some of the worrisome trends, is nothing's inevitable. We can still shape history. We can still get this right. The question is whether we will.
In the same section, you describe World War II as a war brought on by inaction and isolationism, and you describe World War I as, quote, a war of carelessness. When you look at the conditions that led to those wars, do you see any parallels with the present moment?
I see slightly more, probably around World War I, there's a kind of a carelessness. There's a lack of structure. There's a lack of clear-cut balances. I don't see anyone on the scene, say, like Nazi Germany or even Imperial Japan, who are extraordinarily powerful and extraordinarily determined to use military force to totally throw the apple cart over. I don't see anything of that extreme on the negative side. And fortunately, at least so far, the United States and the Europeans and others are not so naive as they were in the 20s and early 1930s. So I don't see the extremes of the period leading up to World War II. What I do see is some elements of the pre-World War I period with a lack of structure. And I also see some elements of probably the closest parallel might be the immediate post-World War I period, the late teens, the early 20s, so where just things are deteriorating, where opposition to trade is growing, where you've got a lot of powers jockeying for position. Democracy seems to be somewhat in retreat, and that the global order, however you measure it, seems to be losing altitude. So that seems to me, if I had to choose a period to compare this to, I would probably compare it to the immediate post-World War I period.
Well, one parallel that we can draw is the sharp rise in nationalism across Europe during the build-up to World War I. Why are we suddenly seeing a return of nationalism and also authoritarianism in the 21st century? And not just in the obvious places like China or Russia, but also the Philippines, Turkey, Eastern Europe. The world has been on a steady path of democratization for almost the past 75 years, and now it seems to be reversing. Why is this happening now, Richard?
It's a great question, and it's one I struggle with myself. I think in part it has to do with economic circumstances, the drift in middle-class incomes in many places. I think that had an effect. The 2008 financial crisis hurt. Upward mobility in places like the United States became more a dream than a reality. I think all of that had to do with something. I think the globalization threaten certain jobs, as we've seen, as did new technologies. There's a certain fear or concern of being overwhelmed. International institutions haven't kept up. So for all these reasons, and I probably left some out, we're beginning to see a kind of going back to what seems safe, and people are more vulnerable to some of the siren calls of authoritarianism. And I also think that we probably contributed to this trend in one other way. We haven't set a good example. History is in part the competition for ideas. And when American democracy and American society and the American economy don't succeed, well, others don't want to emulate us. And instead, they're more open to those who would pull them in an authoritarian direction.
Well, in your book, you have a section that addresses specific challenges that the world currently faces, and one of them is climate change. If I'm reading this right, it seems to be more toward the top of the list for you. Setting aside President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, why hasn't the global community done a better job of meaningfully addressing climate change?
Well, first, in part, because there is no global community. You know, the phrase is used a lot, an international community, global community, but right. In fact, there isn't one. The interests diverge in many areas. Also, when you think about it, countries that are at very different points in their own development. There's a big difference, say, between Europe and the United States, which are mature, developed economies, and, say, a country like India, which is 1.3 billion people with a per capita income of, what, maybe $2,000? So India feels tremendous pressure to grow. And you still, for example, have hundreds of millions of people in India who don't have access, regular access to electricity. Or China is a country of equal size, 1.3 billion people, where the legitimacy of the Communist Party in recent decades has rested more than anything else on economic performance. And that meant environmental or climate concerns took a back seat, if they even got a seat at all. And then within every country, including the United States, you have various constituencies that are pushing back for this or that reason. So it's just very hard to get a consensus. And then there's one other thing. When you think about it, climate change is it's a special kind of crisis. And it's a really difficult one for countries to deal with because it's a gradual or slow motion crisis. Mm-hmm. It's one thing when you have a 9/11. It happens and then it's sudden, you can deal with it. Or even this pandemic, which is a relatively sudden phenomenon. But something that's gradual, it's very hard to give to communicate a sense of urgency. And I think that's true of something like climate change. I think it's something true about our accumulation of debt. It's probably true about predictions, say, about the future disappearance of many jobs because of artificial intelligence or robotics. It's very hard to mobilize a government. This is true, democracies and non-democracies alike, to meet long-term problems when most leaders will say, hey, I don't have the luxury of worrying about the long term. I've got to navigate my way through the short term and the medium term. I gotta keep myself, you know, floating until then. So it's just very hard to do it. The problem then is we won't really, I think, react sufficiently to climate change until it's far, far worse and our options are far, far poorer. And I think we're getting close to that point because climate change is not just a future threat, it's a present reality. But my guess is our ability or willingness to mobilize will be too little too late.
Yeah, I will say this. You don't seem very optimistic that we're going to be able to address this before it's a little too late. And you do point out that climate change is not just a major humanitarian, economic, and health problem, but also a national security issue as well. For Americans who might not see the direct effects on them, what are the national security implications of inaction on climate change?
Well, you'll have all sorts of things. It'll cause a lot more refugees and people moving around the world, and that could become a source of conflict. Certain countries won't be able to thrive anymore. And what we've learned is when countries really can't do well, then terrorists, drug cartels, and other such groups tend to fill the vacuum. And as we've learned the hard way, they are not just local problems, but very quickly they can become global problems. It'll have an economic effect on us because we'll find fewer financial partners, but it will also affect us tremendously indirectly. We see it already with storms. We're going to see parts of the United States become less habitable, either because of really hot weather, because of regular flooding, because of frequent violent storms. It'll have tremendous impact on agriculture, tremendous impact on disease, insects, and the rest. I think we are dramatically underestimating the actual and potential import of climate change. There are still things we can and should do to slow it down, to head it off, or head some of it off. A lot of it, though, is baked into the cake already. There are certain things that we're going to want to do to adapt to either existing or inevitable climate change. But the lack of priority that has been given to it seems to me something that we will look back on and truly regret.
And I do want to say one of the best things about this book is all the wonderful maps and graphics that really drive home a lot of the points that you're trying to make. And in here, you have a chart of countries most affected by terrorism with Iraq and Afghanistan at the top, India, the Philippines, a number of countries way more than the U.S., even Turkey, Thailand, the U.K., sure. Colombia had at least twice as many attacks as the U.S. did in 2017 when this was taken. I think only 65 terrorist attacks here. So why do you suppose now here we are two decades after 9/11, terrorism still ranks so highly in terms of national priorities, our politics, and our allocation of resources?
Probably several reasons. One is it has had some impact in the past, and when it does, it's stunningly dramatic. Mm-hmm. 9/11 obviously being the most dramatic experience. And everybody, it's a little bit like fear of a lightning storm, and I don't mean to make light of terrorism, but it's something that people can relate to. It's personal in some ways. People knew people that could imagine being themselves a victim of terrorism. And there's also a good reason to be very worried about terrorism, not just that it's real and it has been real, but one can imagine horrifically if terrorists ever got a hold of nuclear material or chemicals or some biological agents, one can imagine what could they do with it. So we are right to be concerned about terrorism. So I think that's all legit, but you're right. What I sent you in your question, and I think it's a fair point, is we've also got to keep perspective. It doesn't mean we should do less against terrorism, but we should do more against other threats. More than 80,000 Americans have already died. Here it is, in mid-May from the COVID-19. Well, roughly 3,000 people died on 9/11. If you add up all the Americans in history who have died from terrorism, it's not even, it's probably barely a tenth of the people who have died from COVID-19. Again, the conclusion I draw is not to let up in the effort against terrorism, but is we've got to do more against other global challenges, including something like COVID-19. The fact, the fact that it's finally happened, the question is, do we go back to where we were before and ignore it again? Or do we basically now make this a permanent part of our vigilance, a permanent part of our efforts to build resilience in our society, so we're prepared for COVID-25 or COVID-28 if and when they hit us?
And terrorism is a direct byproduct of the instability of the nations where it finds refuge. You have a chapter in here on internal instability and war within countries. I tend to think that the world is becoming more stable, but you point out in here that there have been an average of 20 internal conflicts a year since the Cold War ended in 1989, and one in five people still live in what would be defined as fragile states. You make the distinction between weak states and failed states. How do countries go from being weak states to failed states?
I'll get to that in a second, but I think the basic point is critical, that wars between countries have become less common and less frequent, mm-hmm. but conflict within countries has become far more prevalent. And that to me is dangerous because it's not just a humanitarian nightmare, but also it can ultimately lead to wars between and among states. So I think it's critical. The difference between a weak state and a failed state is one of degree. It's simply a question of to what extent can governmental authority keep the peace? Can it provide basics to the citizens? Does it have the ability to extend its authority over all the territory? And in weak states or fragile states, all of these things are pressured. All of these things are limited. And a failed state is when it simply doesn't exist, that you may have a government, but the government may only sit in parts of the capital and isn't able to extend its writ over most of the country. Or you may have local groups, terrorist groups, you may have gangs, you may have drug cartels, you may have groups like a Hezbollah, as you see in parts of the Middle East, and so forth, that extend authority and quasi-governmental-like ways over pieces of territory. So you have all this subnational activity going on, and we're seeing that now in places like Yemen. We're seeing that in Libya. Obviously, we've seen it for a long time in Syria, and we've seen it in parts of Africa. And it's real. Nothing good ever comes of such situations.
And there's been a reluctance on the part of our leaders here in the U.S. to engage in nation building in the wake of Iraq and Afghanistan. But you point out that nation building, of course, worked both in Germany and Japan following World War II, as well as Colombia more recently. Are there places today where a limited, focused effort to build state capacities and internal order might be warranted?
Absolutely. I think we've got to be judicious in where we apply it, and we shouldn't be impatient, and we shouldn't think that the answer is necessarily at the end of a gun. I think we tend to over-militarize nation building. In some cases, we also get too ambitious. Places don't need to be perfect Jeffersonian democracies. Some places just need to be good enough. But I would say Central America, Mexico, are places where you have weak states, conversation we were just having, where you have military or police forces that are not able to keep order in the country, aren't as strong in many cases as gangs and cartels, where you have judicial systems that are corrupt and don't have respect or authority, where you have penal systems, where the prisons and the rest are dangerous, lawless places. And that was the situation in Colombia, where you also had a civil war going on. And it took over a decade. The United States partnered with the government there. And we didn't fight a war there. But what we basically did was we built capacities, military capacities, policing capacities, legal capacities, economic capacities. And Colombia today is one of the strongest countries in the hemisphere. What worries me is Mexico could be needy, in need, or not worries me, but I think as a fact of life, Mexico is in need of help. COVID-19 will weaken what authority there does exist, but you have a situation where the leadership there is not willing to accept it. Central America, the Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, countries like that, which are hemorrhaging people. And if people are not sure they agree with me, one thing I'd say is you can't be serious about controlling who comes into our country. You can't be serious about a robust immigration policy and not want to do a bit of this. Immigration policy at the end of the day can't begin at the border. Immigration policy ends at the border. I understand that. But it needs to begin at the source. And we need to address the conditions that lead people to want to flee in the first place. So yes, I think nation building is still extremely important, both as a humanitarian enterprise, but also as something very much in our self-interest.
And speaking more broadly, you have a section about the different regions of the world and the major issues and players therein. Looking ahead a decade or two, maybe even a little farther than that, what region of the world do you think will present the greatest challenges?
Let's be optimistic for a second before okay. We talk about challenges.
Let's try to.
I think Asia still looks like the part of the world that has the potential to be the most successful. You've got a lot of thriving economies. You've got countries that have very strong national identities. They don't struggle with some of the situations you say have in the Middle East, where you've got multiple ethnic groups in the country. You've got very strong social cohesion. Now you've got a rising China, and that has to be contended with. And that's where I think the U.S. alliance system is so central. So Asia has done incredibly well for three or four decades, despite or because of great dynamism. And I believe the potential for it to stay stable amidst continued dynamism is there if we're simply smart about how we monitor it and react to it. I'm far more worried at the other end of the spectrum by the Middle East. I see none of the prerequisites of success there within countries or between them. And if the world begins to move to a post oil gas dependency, to a world where fossil fuels don't play such a central role, which at some point we will, a lot of the Middle East is simply not prepared for that. You've also got enormous high populations in places like Egypt, over 100 million people. You've got terrible educational systems. So the Middle East, I mean, it's roughly, 400 million people out of a world of nearly 8 billion. So it's maybe, 5% of the world's population. But I don't see that region in any way on the path to success. Other parts of the world, Africa, Latin America, Europe, what I see in these places is a mixed bag. And I can argue the glass is half full in some areas, the glass is half empty. I would say just about Africa very quickly. That's the part of the world that will have the greatest population increase. So the biggest challenge for Africa is going to be finding jobs for literally the hundreds of millions and potentially billions of people who are going to be born in Africa over the next 50 years. Yeah, but other regions also have challenges. We could talk about it, obviously, Europe, obviously, Latin America, South Asia, what have you. But if I had to say the two extremes right now are probably Asia in the positive sense and the Middle East in the negative sense.
Well, Richard, before we go, you talk a lot about the importance of the liberal world order, and that's small L liberal, by the way. Have terms like world order and globalism simply become too fraught? I mean, what does it say to you that there is a small but growing and certainly vocal segment of the population that for some wild reason believe that organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations or the World Economic Forum or the Gates Foundation, groups that actually do a lot of good in the world, are part of some nefarious New World Order out to curtail our liberties? Or heck, maybe I should just ask you outright, Richard, do you and the Council on Foreign Relations have a secret plan to keep us all under the boot of some nefarious global cabal?
Ridiculous conspiracy stuff. Right. World order is an important concept. World order, as you know, is an important measure, picture, snapshot, but also can pick up trends about the state of the world. And it basically looks at forces of stability and instability. What a former professor friend of mine called forces of society and forces of anarchy. And it looks at the balance and it looks at the trends. And we all benefit from a world in which the reality and the trends favor order, and we all have much reason to fear the opposite. So that's simply a fact of life at any time. You know, phrases like liberal world order, well, that's a historical concept, what came out of the burst of creativity after World War II. And that basically was institutions from the UN to the World Bank to the IMF to the American Alliance System, large economic interaction around the world, spread of democracy to a considerable extent. This is the world that we've lived with for nearly three quarters of a century, and I would argue has served us fairly well. New World Order was a phrase that was used after the end of the Cold War about what would come next. I wasn't a big fan of the phrase, in part because it was never really developed. Content was never really given to it. In my view, we do need a world order, whatever adjective you want to put in front of it. I've called it World Order 2.0. But we need a world in which we not only deal with the traditional challenges to order, where we want to have sovereignty respected, we don't want to have countries invading one another, using military force to intimidate, interfering in one another's politics. So we want to deal with the old agenda, but we also want a world that comes together to deal with the new agenda, to deal with pandemics and climate change and cyberspace and terrorism. So I think the challenge going forward is to have both dimensions, the old and the new, dealt with. And that's what will result in world order. And my argument is it won't just happen by itself. The United States can't bring it about by itself. Unilateralism is no answer. And the United States can't hide from it. Isolationism is not a viable strategy. So I actually think the only way to build a world that deals with the old challenges as well as the new ones and that promotes prosperity and security and health is a world where there is a degree of collaboration, a degree of multilateralism. And again, I think the United States is in the best position to lead it, not as an act of philanthropy, not that I'm against philanthropy, but as an act of hard-headed self-interest. And to me, the biggest question is, will we? And that's a very long answer to say why, in part, why I wrote this book. I think there's a powerful, powerful case that it is in our interest to do so.
Absolutely. And I really enjoyed the book. And I also want to point out that this book is not just for career diplomats or policy wonks. It really explains foreign policy in a way that neither talks down to readers, nor does it talk above readers' heads. It's a great primer on international relations and the challenges we face. I really encourage people to read it. It's called The World, A Brief Introduction. Richard Haass, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Dr. Richard Haass for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The World, A Brief Introduction, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Learn more about the Council on Foreign Relations at cfr.org and follow Richard on Twitter at Richard Haass. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.